From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, the challenges of attracting young people to taking up a life on the farm.
I feel like it might be hard to ask a young person like myself who had a 9-to-5, who had a 401k, benefits, weekends off, to exchange that for a life of farming.
We'll learn about one of the deadliest fires in U.S. and Milwaukee history.
I don't imagine you could have more perfectly designed a system to destroy this building than this elevator shaft that within a few minutes delivered the fire to every floor of the house and the roof.
Plus, the new exhibit, On Belonging, looks at race, identity, and history.
We all come in the middle of a timeline when we are born, and we all have to own the past and understand the past and build towards the future.
Lake Effect Weekend is next, after this news.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Our farming contributor, Dave Kozlowski, owns and operates Pinehold Gardens in Oak Creek with his wife, Sandy Rodenz. They gave up other careers more than a decade ago in order to pursue the demanding and rewarding profession of farming. Kozlowski says it was a steep learning curve, but their fellow farmers were a big help as they got started.
Now the mentee is becoming the mentor. For this month's farming segment, Kozlowski brought along Sarah Krohn of Village Farmstead, which is also in Oak Creek. Krohn gave up her previous career just about a year ago to farm full-time, though she and her partner Sam Oden had almost 10 years of community gardening and hobby farming behind them. Oden's sister will join their team this year as well as they grow organic produce for direct sales to consumers.
Krohn and Kozlowski joined me in the studio recently to discuss their different perspectives on farming, its challenges and rewards. Krohn starts by explaining how she knew she had to become a farmer.
I didn't know anything about farming or business, but I kind of had this moment when I was in college and I didn't really know what I wanted to study, and I kind of had some resistance to joining the workforce and doing a 9-to-5, which I couldn't find anything that I wanted to do, and I studied environmental ethics, and I thought about all these scholars and authors that I was reading about and farmers, and I just thought that this was such a wholesome way to spend my life, just like growing things that we directly need every single day. And so we decided after some years of practice that we would take the plunge and go for it. But we didn't know anything about business, and we're learning that it's definitely a business if we're trying to make a livelihood out of it. But we just learned through experience and from mentors such as Dave and Sandy and other farmers that have welcomed us into the community.
Now, for both of you, you know, what was that learning curve like? And is there still one for you, Dave?
Thankfully, there is still one. I mean, when the job becomes boring and you're not learning something, I don't want to do it anymore. So, yeah, every year is a challenge. Every year we learn something. And, you know, I want to say I met Sam, Sarah's partner, before I met Sarah. I was so impressed with his questions and his interest in the business and farming that I was just thrilled that we had young farmers like this coming into the profession. But yeah, I'm still learning. And I would say our stories are fairly similar. I wanted to make the world a little better place, and we just jumped in with both feet into farming. And at that time, there were a number of small farms doing the same thing in the area. And we took advantage of their generosity and time by stopping and visiting them and learning what they were doing. It's pretty much similar to what Sam and Sarah do. So to me, that's the best way to figure things out. Books help, but really it's just talking to another farmer. And that's what we did. And still do, by the way. We still stop at farms.
For you, Sarah, were you surprised at maybe the number of farms that were available for you and your partner, Sam, to go and learn from, like Dave and Sandy? Because, I mean, do we know the number comparative difference between how many farmers you could go and talk to versus you going into farming now in 2018, 19?
Yeah, I mean, we've lost some, but it probably doubled or tripled in that time. Mm-hmm. We had to drive out west of Madison to find a few farms to talk to.
When we first started, the first thing that we decided to do was let's talk to farmers in the area. Let's find farms that are doing things similar to what we aspire to do. And let's call them on the phone and see if they'll just talk to us. And we did. That's how we met Dave and Sandy. We called him on the phone and said, hey, we're thinking about starting a farm. Can we pick your brain? Do you have any wisdom to offer us? And every single farm that we called was more than willing to have a conversation with us, to invite us over. We've just been so welcomed into the farming community that it's a place that I want to stay. And I definitely hope that more people feel welcomed into it as well.
How do you think you can foster more growth? You know, people of the younger generation, as you mentioned, most go into the 9-to-5 job fields or, you know, the more conventional degrees to study, and they're not thinking per se about working the land. And a lot have lost that family connection to farms. You know, no one has a family farm owned by their grandparents or great-grandparents or have that connection to the land.
Yeah, I think we're in an interesting spot right now. I think a lot of young people are really interested in farming, and they are interested in changing the way that we eat, and they're changing the way that their lifestyles are. I feel like it might be hard to ask a young person like myself who had a 9-to-5, who had a 401k, benefits, weekends off, to exchange that for a life of farming. But I think a lot more people are interested in it, and we try to encourage our friends who want to come over to be put to work. Like, let's do some farming together. And at the end of the day, it's always so rewarding. They feel rewarded. They feel like they made a difference. They feel like the farm is partly theirs, too. And I just think that it's just a good community for people our age to start getting involved in. And I think they're interested in doing it, too.
Yeah, I think there's two tracks we have to sort of keep abreast of here. One is, like Sarah and ourselves and so many young farmers, you have to have the mindset and the philosophy to want to do this. And it doesn't matter whether you're growing organic produce or you want to do dairy cows or corn and soybean. I mean, farming is farming. And so you're going to want to do that kind of work. The other track, particularly as it pertains to us, is for those people who are sitting on the fence, we've got to convince them that you can actually make a living doing this. And there's not much ways we can cut our costs. So we have to hope that the public is interested in buying what we produce.
Right. We do need the people that support organic farming as well. Like, not everyone has to be a farmer, but we have to have the people that understand it and they're willing to maybe spend a little bit more money than they're going to spend at Costco buying something that's organic but doesn't have a face or a name that comes along with it.
Now, you mentioned, Sarah, you know, trading the salaries, you may get benefits, weekends off, vacations. You know, you guys are working probably more than you ever have. How has your relationship with money and risk changed as you've changed to the life of a farmer? How do you see things differently?
Well, risk is, it's always a thing that's in our minds. I happen to be a very frugal person in the first place, which made transitioning to farming relatively easy at this point. We're still very new to it, so I can't really speak for what this means financially for us. But I think that the risk of not having benefits or dental insurance, like, those things are okay for me to exchange for different things that I value, such as being my own boss, working with the sunlight hours, moving my body like it was intended to be moved, and just kind of going with those natural rhythms of the universe instead of these values that society holds up, like weekends and paid vacation. Like, those things are a valid exchange for me.
Farmers, I tend to find, are some of the smartest people I know. And along with that is being able to accommodate these kinds of risks and challenges and meet them head on and find solutions to them rather than crumble under the weight of them. And that seems to be a main tenet of pretty much any farmer if they're going to stay in the business. Managing money, what's money? we don't worry about that part, but the risk is a significant challenge, and you have to be willing to meet that challenge.
Dave, you mentioned that farmers are good problem solvers. I'm curious, what have you both found to be the hardest part about farming, whether there's one particular story, an instance of just a crop that gave you all the difficulties, or just the things that you've learned throughout to adjust to?
That's a tough one. There's a lot of things that are hard about farming, but at this point in the game for me, something that I have noticed is the hardest thing is meeting customer expectations. We live in a world of convenience and busyness, and people have lost their connection with food and they've lost their consciousness about food. And I'm finding that it's hard to take your whole life and turn it upside down to grow this produce so that someone can have a beat at the end of the day. But then a lot of people don't even know what to do with a beet at the end of the day. And we're up against these like food subscriptions where food comes to your door with a recipe and the spices, and sometimes it's pre-cut. And it's like, we've already grown all this food. Like, we can't possibly compete with someone who's doing that. Like, if the customers could meet us halfway, frankly, I feel like it would be nice. Like, we all have to make moves here to change the food system. And I feel like small farmers are doing so much already. And, you know, it has to be a group consciousness thing. And if it's not, I don't know that we're going to be able to compete with all the other food options that are out there.
You kind of want to expect a farmer to say, what's the hardest part of your job? Well, you know, it's 13-hour days or 14-hour days. It's not really. It's not a physical thing. I think it's an emotional thing. Like Sarah says, it's hard to go to a farmer's market and have people not buy your produce, have walked right by you, even some say some nasty things about this stuff. That's emotionally hard because you have a lot of sweat and blood involved in that, in your product. And it's also emotionally difficult to deal with issues like we had last year when you lose an entire carrot crop. It isn't the money. It wasn't the work you put into it. It's just, gosh, you know, how do you bounce back from that kind of loss? So it's an emotional thing, I think.
And, you know, we're talking about the difficult times, but there's also some great successes that you can have throughout farming. And, you know, Dave, you've been in the business for a while, and Sarah, you're pretty new, but do you guys remember your first farm memory where it's like, this is the first plant that I grew successfully, or, you know, what that crop was, or working the land, prepping it for something, and you look and you see and you realize and confirm to yourself, like, yes, this is what I need to be doing?
That happens every spring. It's like happens again and again and again and again. It's always new. When I go out and I scan the field and I can see all the plants coming up and they're all healthy and the weeds have been under control, I get the same thrill I did the first time we did it, when we had one CSA member and we were selling things off the farm, to now with 100 and whatever, 50 or 80 CSA members and selling off the farm. I get the same exact thrill as though it was the first time when I see the plants all in a row, the weeds kept under control, everything looking healthy. Yeah, it just keeps coming back.
My first real experience with that was actually this year. We're doing our first CSA. And when we got our first check in the mail, I almost was brought to tears just thinking, like, these people trust us enough to write us a check for almost $600, and they just trust that we're going to feed them. And it was just, like, so emotional for me just thinking that we have community out there that's willing to trust farmers even though there is a risk. And that's why I'm doing it.
When it comes to the future of farming, how do we get more people like Sarah to consider working a field versus working at a desk?
That's the $10,000 question, isn't it? Yeah. You know, I think, as we sort of mentioned before, partly you have to have the mindset. And sometimes it's not when you're 20 years old. Sometimes it's when you're, you know, in 30s or 40s. But so you have to have the mindset. And secondly, we have to show them that this is a profitable, interesting, challenging business to get into, that it's not just purely grunt work. You know, like I said before, I think farmers are some of the smartest people I know. They know how to fix things, they know how to plant things, they know how to sell things, they can manage money. They're an incredible group of people. So we need to continue to be successful, and then that success, I hope, breeds success.
Yeah, and another thing I think that might get in the way of young people farming is just access to land, and having land be so expensive, and so many of us are still paying off student loans. Yeah. And in our case, we live on a homestead, 14 acres, and not everyone who lives at the homestead is involved in the market farm. But we could never afford to live where we live if we didn't live with a group of people that was helping to pay for the property taxes and just all the costs that come in with living in that space.
That's the other thing that changed in the last 25 years. There was really no money available for us to start a farm back then. But now the USDA does offer new farmer grants and loans. And it sounds like I don't know the details of it, but show them a good business plan, show them that you have some experience, that you did some interning and things like that. And there's the potential for some grants and loans to start your business and expand your business. So that's a good thing. And I think more young people know about that might help. But land's a big issue.
Now, Dave, as we're sitting here with Sarah, I'm sure you're reminded of those first, you know, few seasons where you and Sandy were getting things started. Do you, either of you have questions for each other, you know, while we're here?
I remember our first farmer's market, which was last June, and we're coming from a conventional field, and so we have a lot to make up for in fertility. And I just remember looking at our first market stand and being like, I wonder what Dave's market stand looked like for the first time. Like, I hope his vegetables looked worse than they look now, because there's hope for us that we'll
get
better. But yeah, it's just like, how have you seen difference in when you first started farming and first started working the land? And have you seen your soil grow? And have you seen the biodiversity change on your land?
Yeah, the first stuff was pretty good. We were on old pasture, not conventionally farmed land. So it had been in pasture for years and years and years. We had weed problem and grass problem, but the fertility was really good. It was the in-between years when we started to move on, where it took us a while to get the fertility up in the soil. And we're still working on that. As you know, we have very clay soils around here, and they take a good deal of organic matter and to keep them going. But I thought your stuff looked great. But that's always the case. You know, that's always the case. You're always going to get fork carrots that you're not going to bring to the market. Mm-hmm. That's what, you know.
That's what
kimchi is all about, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, you're always going to get product like that. And you always want to bring your best product to the market. So don't let those other farmers there fool you, too, because they got a lot of fork carrots and a lot of, you know, blemished radishes and whatnot.
Dave, anything for Sarah?
Yeah, I'm curious about the business plan and how you guys want to grow the business and how you plan on growing the business, because the way we did it seemed really backwards back in the bad old days when the hippies and hippie wannabes started this business and got into it. We just planted and sold. We didn't really think about what the future would be. You know, everything was in the present. That was a big mistake. I mean, I wish that I was more of Sam and Sarah when we were younger and we were starting this business, to have more of a business plan. We'd look different than we are now. We just sort of just kept growing things and selling things and growing things without any business plan.
We definitely have a business plan, but it's more so we have set financial goals for ourselves. And Sam is totally the mastermind behind all the planning, all the finances. I try to be involved in that as less as I can. But we have basically started with, how much money do we hope to make so that we can pay for a year of life? And so we start there, and then we go, how much money do we need to make each week in order for that yearly salary to come to fruition? And then from there, we say, okay, how much do we need to sell of these things to make this much money? And that's where we plan our crops from. So it's kind of starting at a totally made up point and then working from there to figure out what our year is going to look like.
Yeah, but you're new. You have to start. You have to create a baseline.
Yeah. And so we went with something last year. We got to a certain point, and so we recalibrated for this year, and we thought about what was realistic based on our 1 year of business experience.
Did you overestimate last year or underestimate?
We didn't meet our goal, but we had a high goal.
Do you have any words of advice for Sarah going forth? And then, Sarah, do you have any advice or words of encouragement for people who are perhaps on the fence about getting into farming themselves?
I don't even have to tell her this, because I'm sure that it's in her heart anyways, but don't lose the feeling, because that's what's important. I need to make money, but I would gladly give my vegetables away if I could.
Cool. Yeah, I like that mentality. And for people that haven't started yet and are thinking about it, the best thing that I can tell you is try growing some food and try seeing how it goes. Like, it's not going to be perfect your first time, but the most you can do is just start and try and talk to people. And if you're interested, there's so many people there that could use a hand on their farm if you want to get some experience or want to work. Just ask. Farmers are really nice people, and they'll usually always talk to you.
Farming contributor Dave Kozlowski owns and operates Pine Hole Gardens in Oak Creek with his wife, Sandy Rodens. Sarah Krohn owns and operates Village Farmstead in Oak Creek with her partner, Sam Oden. You can find out more and listen to previous farming conversations at WUWM.com.
Coming up, we'll learn about Milwaukee's new Hall House Fire, which remains one of the deadliest hotel fires in U.S. history. Like Fact Weekend returns in a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. In the late 1800s, Milwaukee was a city defined by industry. Among other things, the city was the world's largest primary wheat market, which made the city a hub of business. Like other wealthy Milwaukeeans, grain trader Daniel Newhall capitalized on the influx of people by creating a luxury hotel, which was known as the Newhall House. At six stories, it was one of the largest buildings in the country when it was built in 1857.
History remembers the new house not for its opulence, but for the gruesome event that transpired there one January night in 1883. At the time, the Newhall House fire was the deadliest in U.S. history. Although it lasted less than an hour, at least 75 people were killed.
Author Matthew Prigge's new book, Damn the Old Tinderbox, chronicles what happened at every step of the fire, how people survived, and how they perished. He recently joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio and starts by explaining what fire precautions were in place in the 1880s.
Fire safety at the time, just during the whole era of the Newhall House, was pretty primitive. The Newhall House by the 1880s had fire escapes, but there were no signs indicating to where the fire escapes were. There were fire hoses, but there was no regulation by the city that they be maintained in any way.
The fire department, and the title alludes to this, did think of the Newhall House as a sort of tinderbox, that a fire was going to happen there.
Well, there had been fires there in the past. No one had ever been injured or lost their lives. But fire at the time was sort of this omnipresent danger no matter where you were. I don't think that the Newhall House was any more safe or dangerous than other hotels in the city or most buildings where the public would have gathered. There was this odd sense at the time when I was researching this, both from the fire department and contemporary accounts and the accounts of the people who were in the house that night, that everybody was aware that this could happen and probably would happen, but still nobody really took the initiative to be proactive about minimizing the risk of catastrophic loss of life.
Well, and as you say, it did seem like it was a kind of omnipresent danger, as in a fire could happen kind of at any moment. And,
right.
And there had been fires, as you mentioned. What made this fire different from what had previously happened at the Newhall House?
For one thing, the fire happened very late at night. It was about 3 a.m. There were only three staff members on duty at that time. Everybody was asleep, so it was kind of an ideal time for a fire to take hold of the building. And even more impactful than that was where the fire started. It started at the base of the elevator shaft in the Newhall. Now, the Newhall, the elevator was installed in the 1870s, and the elevator shaft was wooden-lined. The elevators in those days at the top, they had they called a cap. It was essentially an open-air top to the elevator shaft with a little roof built over it. Also, it being in January, it was very cold outside. It was much warmer inside the house. So the air was being drawn up the elevator shaft toward the roof. And once the fire got going at the base of that, it was, I don't imagine you could have more perfectly designed a system to destroy this building than this elevator shaft that within a few minutes delivered the fire to every floor of the house and the roof. The elevator operator was the one who actually discovered the fire. He was coming down in the elevator and noticed the smoke coming up through the floor. By the time he had discovered it and jumped off the elevator and told the front desk clerk that there was a fire, it had probably already reached the roof.
You know, something the book focuses on is the many missteps that happened at the beginning of the fire and then throughout as it was starting to spread. Mm-hmm. What were those initial missteps?
Well, the standing orders at the hotel, whether quasi-official orders from management or in the event of a fire, to first try to fight the fire in-house. you know, the more callous view of this is that they didn't want to wake up any guests or tarnish their reputation at all, which was, I believe, part of it. But also, there's a more practical means to this, to try to, you know, if you see a fire, to try to put it out as soon as you can. But again, with just how the fire had started and how it was discovered, by the time, and we're talking just in the span of a few minutes here, but by the time the two staff members had gone into the basement to try to assess the situation, it was already well beyond control. I don't think that anything really could have been done to put the fire out once it had been discovered. But the key thing that went wrong with two of the three people who were on duty that night was they didn't wake up any of the guests. One went to wake up the proprietor of the hotel, who actually lived in one of the hotel's rooms, but not in the building proper. It had expanded into the next door building. The boiler operator actually went up to the fifth floor to try to wake up the women who lived there, the domestic workers. And the third guy called the fire department and just sort of waited around for them to show up. So one of the things I keep coming back to in the action of this, in the narrative of the book, is, you know, using timestamps to, you know, 15 minutes since they discovered it. And deep into the situation here, no one had made an attempt to wake up any of the guests. Pretty much all of them woke up either to the noise of the confusion in the hallways, or the smell of smoke, or the glass transoms above their doors shattering from the heat.
And as you mentioned in the book, there was in fact a very famous guest, a man who was very famous at the time, known as General Tom Thumb from P.T. Barnum's Circus.
Correct. The hotel seemed to be favored by traveling theater companies. So there are a few different theater companies staying there, and among them was the Tom Thumb Show. General Tom Thumb was a little person. At the time, he was kind of at the tail end of his career. He had been, a few decades earlier, probably among the more famous people on Earth.
Well, this was a man who had met with the King and Queen of England, the President of the United States.
Yeah, he was very well known, one of the first celebrities, if you will. And he traveled with a group of performers and also with some very valuable diamonds and coins, which were lost in the fire. And he was afterwards quite adamant about the police trying to locate his missing coin collection.
But he and his wife, and most of his troop, it seems, were able to escape the fire.
Yeah, he survived by being, well, his room had the very good fortune of actually having a small balcony that would have overlooked, would have been on Michigan Street, basically, if you're familiar with the Chamber of Commerce building there and the Mitchell building and the Swingin' Door Tavern right there on that street. That would have been overlooking out at that part of Michigan Street. So his escape was among the more simple of everyone who got out that night. They had a ladder up to his balcony, and he climbed down, and then a police officer carried his wife right after him.
Which was lucky for them. How did most of the guests escape?
Most of the guests who escaped did so through the hallways. How I ended up structuring the narrative in the book was just kind of started at the lower floors and went upward. Because in researching all this, basically the higher up you were in the hotel, the less your chances were of surviving. Most of the people on the main floor, the second floor of the building, which was the first floor of the hotel, the actual ground floor, had offices and shops and things like that. But the people who were staying on the second floor, pretty much all of them woke up to smoke or noise and made their way out through the hallways. But if you were staying on the third floor or higher, you probably had a pretty rough go of it trying to get out, because by the time you woke up, the hallways were very hot, very filled with smoke. And we're not talking about a complicated building that's got a very complicated layout here. There were two huge stairways. All the hallways were straight shots that could either go right to the stairway or go around a corner, and you were at the stairway. But people got out there, and they got very disoriented. Survivors talked about running around inside the hotel for what seemed like 5 or 10 minutes trying to, and then ending up just tumbling down the stairs or running into someone else who dragged them out. The people who couldn't make it out into the hallways, they were mostly forced back to the windows in their rooms. And the fire department's life-saving mechanisms back then were pretty rustic, and it was not a sure thing that even if you could get to your window and, you know, see the rescue ladders being raised, that they're going to be able to get to you.
They did have some issues with the rescue ladders, and it raised a larger question. As this fire is going on, what were the mechanisms that a fire department more generally could use to combat a fire at this time?
By the time the fire department got there, again, I talked about how quickly the fire took hold of the building. They had pretty much abandoned hope of doing anything from inside. So they were out on the sidewalks, sending water into the windows to try to, really by that point, just to try to make it as easy for people to escape if they still could. But because by that time, it was pretty much a given that the building was going to be a loss. The ladders they had were of limited use, given the design of the building and just the realities of the fire department's staffing situation. Actually, the ladders that they had that had the highest reach, I think they took 6 men to operate, and this was above the means of most fire companies. So they had these 2 large cranks to extend the ladder to these windows, and actually had to grab people off the street to help operate this fire department machinery that the fire department didn't have enough people to operate. Shorter ladders, they had trouble with the telegraph cables that were, you know, if you can imagine where they, like the power lines would be today. The Newhall House being what it was kind of a communications hub for the area with a lot of business people staying there. So there are these huge sets of telegraph cables surrounding the building coming up off the sidewalks. So they had to maneuver these ladders around these cables. This is the way the building was designed. Its elaborate design made it difficult to get the ladders flush up against the side of the building. They could really only reach the 3rd and 4th floors with these ladders just because of the way everything was designed. And this is also a very slow-moving process, having to manually move these ladders from window to window. And during this process, which again was the whole hotel was ruined in about 40 minutes, a lot of people waiting in their windows chose to jump. And the fire department did have jumping sheets. If you, I always think of it from old cartoons when they hold out that thing and somebody tries to jump into it. But the reality of those was pretty gruesome as well. They needed like 20 people to hold one of these taut to actually support the weight of somebody leaping from a great height into it. And again, they're very understaffed, so they have not enough people holding these things. People jumped towards these sheets and either missed them or, you know, went right through the middle because there wasn't enough people holding it. So if you ended up on the windows, your chances of survival were not great.
So in total, how many people died in this fire?
Using the missing persons, the known persons lost, and then the rather gruesome business of removing the bodies of the people who didn't escape after the hotel was ruined, I've come to 75, and I think that's a pretty solid estimate.
What was the aftermath like here in Milwaukee and, you know, throughout the country in some ways?
Well, the immediate aftermath was, I mean, this was international news after it happened. It was the deadliest hotel fire at the time up until 1947. And again, still one of the deadliest hotel fires ever. So the immediate aftermath was one of, you know, a lot of shock, a lot of sorrow. There was some call for reform after this, but it didn't really go anywhere. And that was one of the interesting things I found out when I was doing all this research, was that despite all the very obvious flaws in the systems within the system of the fire department, of city regulations, of building codes, not much was done to prevent this from happening again. In fact, later in 1883, there was a fire at the Plankinton House Hotel, which by the 1880s had overtaken the Newhall as the premier hotel in Milwaukee. And, you know, despite all of the, from the newspapers, all the condemnation of, you know, the people who ran the house, saying it was unsafe, and so on and so forth, the fire at the Plankinton was started by a steam pipe that was sitting on a wooden bracket, ignited the fire in the basement. One of the same flaws that were found at the Newhall House. But the fire at the Plankinton, it happened during the dinner hour. Everybody was awake. They got to it quite early. There was a brief panic. Everybody you know, ran out into the streets, but the fire department was able to get there and put it down and without any major injury. And even after that, the fire department kind of readily admitted that, you know, if this had happened at 3 a.m., we probably would have had another Newhall House fire situation. And even after that, like, really nothing happened. Not nationally, not even locally. It really wasn't until the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in New York City that real fire safety regulation began to reform, began to take hold. And that was 40-some years later.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Matthew, for joining me here in studio and talking about your work.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Matthew Prigge is a Milwaukee-based writer and the author of Damn the Old Tinderbox, Milwaukee's Palace of the West and the Fire That Defined an Era. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers before a past Boswell Book Company event, but you can find more information at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break and then speak with two artists whose latest exhibit considers what it means to be an American as it explores history, American identity, and where women's stories fit in. Lake Effect Weekend continues with that in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell has his series called I'm an American. So far, people from all walks of life have examined this question through their unique stories, and you can see all of them at WUWM.com.
An exhibition that's currently on view at the Warehouse Museum on West St. Paul Street also offers some answers to that question, what it means to be an American. On Belonging is a three-part visual and audio collaboration between Milwaukee interdisciplinary artist Nirmal Raja, who emigrated here from India almost 30 years ago, and photographer Lois Bielefeld, who grew up here. The works in the exhibit examine race, place, and our connection to and place in history. Both artists stopped by the studio a few weeks ago to tell us more, starting with Bielefeld.
What we were most interested in is just what everyone was thinking and what, as far as, I think there's this just general idea that I'm not a part of history. How could I be a part of history? Even though we all have personal histories, we all witness in different ways of witnessing. That could be through television or Facebook or actual, you know, being a part of history. And that can be through voting or just, you know, going, attending a local...
A rally or a...
Correct.
Yeah. So the idea is, like, to bring history... As a concept down into the more personal?
To have a discussion of our understanding of history and of the past.
Yeah. And I think especially as an immigrant, it is even more, visible, this entry into a different history, because you enter in a timeline of a nation, but at the same time you inherit what's happened in the past that you had no part of. And so how do you understand that?
And if you think about it, you've been here almost 30 years, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes. But also, we all come in the middle of a timeline when we are born. And we all have to own the past and understand the past and build towards the future. So that helped us come up with a questionnaire and involve other women who are often left out of history. History becomes a fact sheet of the victors, mostly male and white. So this project is primarily based on women and giving visibility and voice to women.
One of the women that we interviewed said it's like a river, and there's all of these, you know, smaller creeks and just bodies of water that come together, and it's constantly flowing and it's constantly moving and changing. And we both just really love that metaphor.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So how did this thought about history and considering particularly women's history that's seldom, at least until recently, been recorded, how did that work into an art project that the two of you were collaborating on?
We were walking down the Riverwalk, right behind Riverfront Pizzeria. There is an engraving on the boardwalk of Wisconsin and American history. And we were just fascinated by the fact that there were gaps in the timeline itself and also how women were invisible in that timeline. And so we started talking, and the idea of doing a rubbing of this timeline and perhaps using it as a prop for performance-based photography emerged out of our conversations.
Okay, so you did the engraving, and it's on cloth, right? And it's big.
Yes, it's 30 meters long. And I only did just a few sections of it, focusing on major historical events like the Civil War, the World Wars, and the Civil Rights Movement.
And so, Lois, where did you come in on this?
Right. So Nirmal was doing the rubbing, and I asked if I could do some documentary work of her actually doing the physical rubbing. And so I was just photographing, doing some video work, and then I think we just naturally had this idea of recording audio of the actual physical rubbing and then having her say different words as she was rubbing to just consider what was being physically rubbed into this fabric. And that we sourced that to go on a single channel video that we have that was our first performance piece of interacting with this timeline. So we made 12 still photographs and also a video of Nirmal one day just completely interacting with this fabric and thinking about contending with history. And this fabric has become a metaphor for what history is, a visual metaphor.
Mm-hmm. In some of those pictures, you're completely wrapped up in it. It's like you can't get out of it. Mm-hmm. And others, you are more in control of it.
Yes.
It's interesting to look at the differences.
We've had many conversations on current events and how I think the Charlottesville riots had happened and this debate on Confederate monuments being removed and the violence that ensued. And so we started questioning how someone's relationship with one monument is so different from the other. And so there's this always this struggle. So there's so many emotions that emerged where, as an immigrant, I want to embed myself in this history, but also refuse the parts that I just do not agree with, you know. So, and or try to change it in some way, bring in other narratives that would hopefully give a different perspective. So these are the different kinds of emotions that I hoped to convey through the different poses.
For the two of you, because you're both so immersed in your practice and in your ways of expressing, talk a little bit about approaching this through art versus just having a conversation or something else. I mean, do you think about it differently when you think about it in terms of your practice?
I think it just becomes this much more in-depth, you know, conversation both internally, but then what comes out in form and in the actual piece. I mean, when Nirmal first approached me to collaborate, it was early 2016.
Late 2016, I think, or early 2017.
Early 2017. And, I mean, our country completely changed. And we were both feeling similar. I was feeling this call to action that I needed to make work to respond to the time. And I think Nirmal very much so felt the same. We were both questioning, is our work relevant now? I mean, my work predominantly is about what it means to be human and about just our simple rituals and, you know, ways of being. And all of the sudden, you know, I felt that people's basic rights were being potentially taken away. And I really felt that this need to respond. And so when Nirmal, you know, reached out and gave me this opportunity, I think it just was immediately like, okay, this is how I can now bring this into form and bring it into my practice.
Yeah, I think as artists, it's a constant effort to bring or bridge the practice with life, almost wishing that there was no barrier. And in a lot of ways, there isn't, because you're the one that's connecting both. So mm-hmm. I often describe myself as this porous membrane where experiences are filtered through the body and comes out in the work. And so what is going on around us definitely has an impact on what we do in the studio. And so this act of reaching out to Lois was just so natural and visceral to me as a response to what was happening in the political climate.
Had you worked together before?
No.
We didn't know each other.
Right.
We've seen each other's work.
Yes. So you reached out having seen her work but not really knowing her at all.
Yeah,
wow.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, Normal sent me an email and with a proposal, and I just immediately was like, yes, this is it. And of course, we needed to meet and sit down and discuss further, but...
Yeah.
Has the project changed since that initial meeting?
Absolutely.
Yes.
So it started out as one body of work, and then the history came second.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It started out with me coming back from India and being met at O'Hare with protests as the Muslim ban was announced, the travel ban, right when I was in the air. And it really felt like I was coming back to a different country. Also, we had moved, and I was unpacking two suitcases of saris that I barely wear. I wear them to Indian occasions, but not really. I feel shy or, you know, very different. I think most immigrants would just want to blend in and not be so so different. And so this idea came about that demanded a sophisticated photographer and artist to collaborate with, because photography itself has such an important nature, the indexical nature of documenting something within the environment. So I sent a proposal to Lois saying that I would like to wear each one of my saris and perform the act of occupying different spaces in Milwaukee. And would
in
you
the
be,
saris.
In the saris. Would you be able to work with me in photographing? Because Lois has this beautiful sense. A lot of people describe her as the quintessential Midwest photographer, the sensibility that she has of capturing so many different aspects of the Midwest. So it was important that it be done right, because the idea has the risk of becoming kitsch. Or exotic. So it had to be that perfect balance of somebody who's different, wearing something very different, but also within the environment of Milwaukee. So this was a perfect partnership for us.
And those photos are, they're just so beautiful, because you're in one, you're walking across bridges, you're standing in different places, you're wearing them. And yeah, I see what you mean. It could risk being like, oh, look at this exotic flower in the middle of, you know, this gray landscape or something like that. But it doesn't feel that way at all. They feel very much like you own this space too.
Yes. And the sari, actually, it was a default, kind of an act of being authentic. But what I would really like to think about the sari in this body of work is as a substitute, perhaps, for the hijab or for any other ethnic garment, or the Sikh turban, for example, how visible race is with regards to garments and skin color and all of the factors that go into our perception, initial perception of race.
So this was the first part of the project. How did it morph into including the timeline, the history timeline? When did the projects become melded together?
So we were exploring Milwaukee as place and really thinking in depth about Milwaukee. Me having grown up here and then leaving for 12 years and moving back and claiming, you know, Milwaukee as my place to live and raise my daughter and thrive. And then Nirmal as, you know, also being here for almost 30 years and raising her kids here, but it not necessarily always feeling like home, but it is home. So there's these interesting, I would say, tension points in what home is. So considering what Milwaukee, and thinking about the mundane places of going just grocery shopping and then the quintessential like state fair, and exploring that way. And I think somewhere either you introduced me to the timeline because it's close to your apartment.
Yeah, and we did shoot under the Hoan Bridge.
Yes.
And that's right where the timeline is. So our conversations led to that. But I think the notion of belonging goes across both bodies of work, because whose voice, who's represented in the history and who's represented in the current moment in this place is also similar.
Well, who belongs?
Yeah.
And who doesn't?
Exactly.
Do you feel like you belong after almost 30 years?
You know, it's interesting. I think this project has made me belong. It really has been such an amazing transformation from where I started 2 years ago to where what I feel now. I feel like I have a sense of ownership and connection to the community now that I did not have. So like most of my art projects, if you approach the work through inquiry, a spirit of inquiry, you might come to a conclusion at the end of it, and that's what has happened. Yes, I do feel like I belong now.
Before I let you both go, now that you've concluded this 2-year journey with each other, do you have other things in mind that you want to do with each other? Has this started a wonderful friendship that will continue in the future?
Yes. I mean, just such a dear friendship. I can't even express.
Yes.
But we've talked about going. I have yet to been to India, and Nirmal has invited me to come at some point in the future. I was hoping to go this past January, but it didn't quite work out. So we've talked about making work there, actually.
Yeah. I think globalism is very dear to me. So thinking globally and making connections through the curatorial work that I do, but also the practice emerges from travel and living between two cultures and countries. And so it's great to be able to travel with Lois, hopefully in the near future, to India and have her see this other side of...
I was going to say, and bring your Midwestern eye to India.
Yes.
It should be very interesting.
Right. Yes.
Right. And it's interesting because I think a lot about representation, and I think about who has the right to tell a story and whose story is it to share. So if I were to go to India, I would probably never photograph there in a serious realm unless I were being commissioned. So my work in the Midwest makes perfect sense. I'm from here. And it becomes intuitively, you know, a part of, it's a part of who I am. And so it makes sense. But reaching across these lines, I think it was definitely needed to have Nirmal there to give that invitation.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing this in its entirety, but I'm also looking forward in the future to whatever else you two come up with. And it's been such a pleasure having you both back in the studio. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Bonnie.
Artist Nirmal Raja and photographer Louis Bielefeld are co-creators of On Belonging. The 3-part exhibition is on view through the end of May at the Warehouse Museum on West St. Paul Street. More information about the exhibit and the museum itself can be found at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned now for All Things Considered coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.